From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Garrison Keillor talks about his new semi-autobiographical novel, Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956, about a 14-year-old boy who discovers pornography and his own urge to write. We'll also talk about recovering from the heart surgery that Keillor had earlier this summer. Also, rock historian Ed Ward brings us up to date on soul singer Howard Tate, who's been making a comeback. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. There's been another confrontation between police and Protestants outside a Catholic school in Northern Ireland. Protestant youngsters threw rocks, golf balls, and other debris over police lines. Police took cover behind armored vehicles, but ended up storming the mob about 2 hours later and making at least one arrest. Earlier today, the violence escalated when Protestant extremists hurled a homemade grenade at schoolgirls and their parents. NPR's Marianne McGuire reports the grenade attack has received widespread condemnation.
The bomb went off as children as young as four made their way to their classrooms. Children started screaming as panic set in. This mother voiced anger as she arrived at the school.
That was attempted murder of young babies and mothers going to school this morning. And for the next one of our politicians or community people to come on the television and say that this protest isn't against children, I don't want to hear it no more.
The attack has sent shockwaves across Northern Ireland. Many children say they don't want to go back to school. Meanwhile, political leaders have been holding talks. The local Protestant residents, for their part, say they will continue their protest tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
Mexico's president wants President Bush to work out a deal on illegal immigration by year's end. Vicente Fox posed the challenge at the White House today. The short time frame took American and some Mexican officials by surprise. The president is considering a guest worker program to give official status to millions of illegal immigrants. The Bush administration today acknowledged that there may not be as many embryonic stem cell lines available to federally funded researchers as originally announced. NPR's Joe Palka reports.
At a hearing before the Senate committee that oversees his agency, Secretary of Health Tommy Thompson admitted that there were probably only about 24 fully established stem cell lines that meet the administration's criteria for study using federal dollars. By fully established, the secretary means that the cells have been shown to grow in the laboratory and have biological properties that prove they are indeed embryonic stem cells. There are another 36 or so lines that may ultimately reach that state, but have not done so yet. Thompson also told the senators that the cells that do exist may yet be available for human therapy, despite having been exposed to animal cells during their preparation. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
Firefighters battling a wildfire that's burned into Glacier National Park finally got some rain today, but they warn that the early morning showers alone are not enough to stop the flames that have burned 64,000 acres in northwestern Montana. But rain and cooler temperatures are a welcome change for firefighters who've been hampered by hot, dry weather and strong winds. The story was mixed on Wall Street today. Dow Jones Industrial Average up 35 points to close at 1033. The Nasdaq was down 12 at 1759. You're listening to NPR News. For the last 2 years, motorists have seen wide fluctuations in gasoline prices. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports that prices once again are on the way up.
For the fourth straight week, gasoline prices have risen. The Energy Information Administration says this past week alone, they're up more than 5 cents a gallon nationally. Over the past month, they're up 16 cents. Pump prices here in the Midwest are a big reason. In the past month, they've soared more than 40 cents a gallon. That makes fuel in Ohio and nearby states the most expensive in the nation, even higher than the usual price leader, California. Analysts blame a fire and shutdown at a Citgo refinery in Illinois. They say when just one oil company is short, all of them raise prices. Another factor in the upward price push, a cutback on oil production by OPEC nations. That took effect September 1st. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
The NFL is increasing its pay offer to league officials. The refs are locked out until a new contract is agreed on. The offer includes a 60% increase in salaries this year, compared with a 40% jump in the NFL's last offer. The rest of the package remains the same, with officials' salaries doubled by 2003. A league spokesman says the NFL has to have an answer by tomorrow in order to make plans for the upcoming weekend games. British Airways and Air France say they are on a fast track to returning their fleet of supersonic Concordes to the skies. Aviation officials from Britain and France today approved plans for the Concorde to resume commercial flights. The British and French fleets have been grounded since a crash outside of Paris last year that killed 113 people. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, the makers of Silk, a lactose-free organic soy milk available in the refrigerated section of supermarkets and natural food stores. Silk is soy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Humorist and best-selling author Garrison Keillor has a new novel called Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. It's set in the fictional town he made famous on his public radio program, A Prairie Home Companion. The story revolves around a 14-year-old named Gary who has discovered pornography and his own sexual urges. He's often compelled to hide what he's reading and what he's thinking and worries that he's condemning himself to hell. At the same time, he's discovered that he loves to write. He's gotten his first typewriter and has started writing about sports for the local paper and to think about the best ways of describing the world around him. The publication of Garrison Keillor's new novel was nearly upstaged by a major drama in his own life. Earlier this summer, he had heart surgery to repair a valve. We'll get to that a little later in the interview. Let's start with a reading from Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. I'll let Garrison set it up.
Here's a boy who's 14 years old sitting on a porch in the summer of 1956 in Lake Wobegon. He's holding a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs, required reading among fundamentalists, and tucked into the book is a magazine, a gift from a classmate, High School Orgies, with suggestive stories of people who suddenly fell in love and in the next minute were naked, and some photographs of them. This pornographic magazine and the pictures of naked people makes the boy remember how he himself looks in photographs and in a home movie that Daddy took last Christmas. I look like a tree toad who was changed into a boy, but not completely. There's still plenty of toadness there. The dark amphibian eyes blinking, the pipe stem arms and wrists, the high water pants, the flappy clown shoes, the Herkimer hair, the steel rim glasses. No sensible woman would marry a guy this creepy. Take a look, and you see this person will never be a normal American. He will live alone and suffer from psoriasis and hemorrhoids and halitosis and earn dollars at home through taxidermy and selling salve. And he will never have true friends, only other geeks who remind him too painfully of himself. But what choice does he have? So he meets them at the spastic center to compare stamp collections, play chess, solve algebra problems, do geek-type things. He may never obtain a driver's license. He'll ride his Schwinn bike to and from Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery, and his old classmates will zoom past in their late model cars and think, whatever happened to old Gary, the creepo, the spaz? Haven't seen hide nor hair of him for years. Zoom, and there I am, the old guy on a bike, the old galoot who totes his necessaries around in a plastic bag, a rubber band around his pants leg, reflective tape plastered on the sleeves and back of his plaid jacket, a reflector pinned to the back of his hunting cap, eating a Little Debbie snack cake. You thrill me so, she whispered as she kissed him, her back arched, her luscious orbs gleaming in the moonlight. This type of thing will not happen for that guy, any more than he will sing and dance in a Broadway musical. That guy's love stick will never be a love stick that any babe thinks of with anything but mute discussed. The high school orgy story about the boy in home ec class. This will not happen for me. The girls are sewing dresses, and the boy sews a tiny leopard skin bathing suit and models it for them. The girls inspect it closely, admiring the handiwork. And suddenly he bursts a seam, and soon they're all naked, their love juices flowing. I find this tremendously exciting, those girlish fingers poking at his pouch. I am going to hell. This is becoming increasingly clear. As Aunt Flo says, you don't get to be a Christian by sitting in church any more than sleeping in a garage makes you a car. What sort of Christian can open up high school orgies to the picture of the home ec girl's breasts with pointy nipples and feel that happy twitching in his shorts?
Garrison, thanks for reading that. And that's an excerpt of Garrison Keillor's new novel, Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. Is this a new turn for you, writing about a boy who's learning about sex and is constantly being aroused by what he reads and is, of course, constantly guilty by reading it and by being aroused by it?
I'm going to just sit here and cry for a while, I think. That passage that you made me read was much too personal and makes me feel terrible. But that's why I went into radio. And yes, it is a new turn, and it all started back the last time we talked. And you asked me a question, which you then sort of withdrew, about my sexual awakening. And it was your withdrawal of the question, as if this might even be an embarrassing thing to talk about, or too personal or something, that made me think, maybe I ought to write about that. So I did. Wrote a book about myself, and then surrounded myself with all of these fictional people.
Well, did you have to, like, steel yourself to write about the discovery of sexuality? Was it really difficult, painful, too personal?
It's painful to think of how I looked at the age of 14, but it's very pleasant to write about this particular summer, a summer in which the discovery of erotic feelings and a sweet romance with my own cousin was all tied in with becoming a writer and experiencing life as best you can when you're 14 in a small town in the Midwest.
Garrison, I'm still kind of thinking about what you said, that it was that question about awakening to your own sexuality that led you to think about writing this book. I mean, if that's true, I'm wondering, like, when you came across something that seemed too personal to discuss, is that when you thought, well, maybe if it makes me uncomfortable, I should go there, I should get deeper into it?
It didn't make me uncomfortable, it made you uncomfortable.
Well, it made me uncomfortable because I thought it made you uncomfortable.
No, you were the one who withdrew the question. And that made me think, maybe I've become too avuncular in my old age.
And
people don't think that I am capable of this sort of thing, or think that this never happened. Perhaps because I'm from Minnesota and grew up in a small town, this Philadelphia sophisticate believes that I'm not capable of having had these feelings.
We're used to being
patronized out here on the prairie, So that was the conclusion I leaped to.
Well, I'm really interested in the books that the character in your novel is reading, which I imagine is similar to the books that you were reading when you were in your very early teens. And these are books that describe breasts as orbs, and men have their manhood or their joystick, and there are many, many other synonyms in there. What were some of the books that you came across during that era of your life?
Pornography, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, we didn't. I didn't have any. I think that when I was 14, I came across in a used bookstore, I came across some nudist magazines. These were blurry black and white photographs of people on a distant hillside who were not wearing clothes. It took a lot of imagination to be aroused by this sort of thing. And when I was 14, I had an incredible imagination. So I've found that exciting. But the sort of writing that you're referring to, this antique pornographic writing, I had to invent in the book. I was a very chaste person in most ways when I was 14.
You know, one of the magazines he's reading is Wild is High School Orgies, and I think there's another one that's like Library Orgy or Orgy in the Library. And I remember when I was a girl, one of my friends found a book hidden away in her father's dresser or something that was called Wild Orgy. And of course, we didn't know what an orgy was, and I assumed that this was about a wild guy named Orgy, kind of like Porgy.
Yes.
I mean, who knew about this stuff? So I was wondering if you had that experience of ever like discovering literature that was really intriguing to you, but was at the same time kind of like over your head sexually.
I discovered a manual in my parents' dresser drawer under some clothing. I guess I must have been looking for it, right? Why else would I have gone in there?
Looking for Christmas gifts.
I guess. I found a manual, and it was... for a manual back then, it was fairly explicit. And it used those words, which I found so exciting, just the words themselves. I guess that's how you grow up to be a writer, is when simply the word penis and the word coitus, the word vagina, are thrilling to you.
No one ever thinks that way about pornography, that it's a wonderful thing for a young person to stumble on. They'll learn a lot about language and the power of writing. But do you think that there's actually some real truth to that?
It's writing that has a big effect on you when you're young. And then you quickly move beyond it, or you're supposed to, or you learn to be secretive about it. But it has a huge effect. The effect of secrets being revealed and forbidden things talked about, and a door opened onto a scene that you were not meant to witness. This is a powerful tonic for a young reader who has read acres of stuff that is pretty predictable and in which a moral, a good moral, is painstakingly laid out, and you can see it coming a mile ahead.
Let me say something else that your character is thinking, and I figure he must be very confused in a way about books, because he's thinking that the family that he's from isn't even comfortable with literature. He says, "We sanctified brethren are people of the word and the great cadences of the King James Version of 1611. We don't hold with literature and its godless drunks and wastrels, but we hold fast to God's literal truth in Scripture." Were you ever confused when you were growing up that, you know, the Bible should be read literally and it was such an important book, but there were a lot of other books that were evil and it was very dangerous, sinful to read them?
Well, the things that you grow up with that are there from the beginning of time, you are slow to question. They simply are part of the landscape that you are raised in. And for me, literal interpretation of Scripture is not a ridiculous idea, as it might be for somebody who came upon it in middle age. This book is about a boy in the summer that he becomes a writer. And I think that the route to becoming a writer by way of the King James Bible is in some ways a more direct route than if he were to read Hemingway and Faulkner and Fitzgerald and the other godless drunks and wastrels that his family warns him against. I don't think the urge to be a writer has much to do with reading great literature. It's something much more basic and primal than that. And if this book has a point, I think it's about that urge to be a writer.
My guest is Garrison Keillor. His new novel is called Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Garrison Keillor is my guest. His new novel is called Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. Well, your character decides in advance on some of the words he wants to make sure he uses in the story. Words like auspicious, thwart, drowse, entreaty, pliant, incipient. Did you do that when you were writing about sports, have lists of words you wanted to incorporate into the story?
Oh, sure, because in the Reader's Digest, which we took in our home, there was this regular monthly feature, what was it called? Building Your Word Power. And each month they gave you a list, with definitions, of course, of 10 words of that sort, auspicious, hairy, sortie. And it was your task to work them into conversation, practice using them, and thereby build vocabulary and thereby become a successful and sophisticated person and have your own radio show and so forth. But yes, I did that as a kid. It was odd to be a little guy sitting around the supper table with your parents and your siblings and trying to get the word abstruse in there somehow.
And did you ever try to write softcore porn yourself?
I didn't, because I knew that I didn't have any experience that could be put down on paper and that other people would find exciting. Mm-hmm. That took a while, and then by the time I did have erotic experience, I had gone down the road of writing humor, and humor and eroticism don't work together.
Well,
did I just make a profound point?
No, I was thinking not necessarily.
Are we changing tapes?
No, I was just trying to think whether that was true or not. And I was thinking they don't work together in an arousing kind of way, but it can be very funny. I mean, writing about sex can be very funny, as you prove in the book.
If it is funny, then it's not erotic.
Right, right. It's not a turn-on. Right.
If a woman having sex laughs out loud,
that's not a good thing.
How does the guy feel about this? Let's stop and think about that. I've heard of this happening, and laughter is not erotic.
What did you write when you got your first typewriter? And I don't mean the sports coverage for the local paper. What were some of the subjects of the stories you wrote for yourself at home?
I wrote, as this boy in the novel does, I wrote things for my teachers, which were pious and polite, and often about nature, about flowers and trees and the beauties of nature. I also wrote vulgar things, scatological things, for the amusement of bigger boys who might want to beat me up. And I, by amusing them, I disarmed them. But I discovered, as the boy does, that the truest task of a writer is the simplest thing, and that is to write it down. What happened? Who said what to whom? What your family talked about around the supper table? Your mother's characteristic phrases? What you thought? What you felt? But more than that, what was said and what people look like and their clothing and how they walk and how they come into a room. All of these simple things, this is the fundamental basis of writing. A writer is somebody who takes notes and who describes the world.
Garrison Keillor. His new novel is called Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost Soldiers, a novel set in present-day Vietnam by James Webb, author of Fields of Fire. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Garrison Keillor about recovering from the heart surgery he had earlier this summer. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us about soul singer Howard Tate. He made a few great recordings in the 60s and then vanished. Recently, he was rediscovered. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Garrison Keillor, humorist, best-selling author, and host of the public radio program A Prairie Home Companion. His new novel, Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956, is the semi-autobiographical story of a 14-year-old boy who has discovered pornography and his own urge to write. Your character in the novel kind of falls in love with his slightly older cousin. And you said you had a cousin who you actually had a relationship like this with. What happened to her? Am I giving too much away if I say what happens to the cousin in the novel?
No, I don't think so.
She has a boyfriend who's part of this kind of rebellious, adventurous, ne'er-do-well type family. And she gets pregnant out of wedlock with her boyfriend. And, of course, you know, the family is just terrified and devastated. And suddenly they're going to become like the kind of people they read about in the tabloids, where something, you know, very awful has happened.
Except the boy is not terrified.
No, he's not. It's a big adventure to him.
The boy thinks to himself, go do whatever you're going to do, and I will write about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did your sister get pregnant like, your cousin, I mean, get pregnant like this?
No.
Why did you want this to happen to the character?
it simply is what happened to the character. She comes into the book at the very beginning. The boy is in love with her, and he admires her. She's a free spirit. She's a rebel. She's not afraid to get into trouble at school. She enjoys being in trouble, whereas he finds it humiliating. So he admires her courage, the courage to act up and to misbehave and to express yourself in flamboyant ways, which she does. For this girl in this town at that time, it seemed to me, writing the book, the most natural thing in the world,
right,
that an older boy, he's 19, pitcher for the baseball team, would fall in love with her, and that her next great adventure would be in the front seat of his Pontiac. And it would have the outcome that all young women feared back in the 1950s. Women who were raised properly, of course.
When you started writing and started writing stories based on people you knew and what your family did and all of that, did you feel that as a writer it kind of gave you permission to not engage as fully in life, but rather to stand back and be the recorder of life?
If you look, as I looked when I was 14 years old, you have a tendency to hang back anyway. I was terribly shy, just painfully, excruciatingly shy as a boy. I had a terrible time just walking into a room, opening a door and walking into a room in which I knew there were people was painful for me. And I was related to those people. I mean, I knew them all. They were not strangers. They were not a jury. So for a person who is unable to be a part of social life, you may as well take notes. Give yourself something to do, and then you can go back and rewrite everything that happened to you.
Was the kind of self-consciousness you felt as a person, was that self-consciousness an asset as a writer?
No, I think it's terrible. I think it's painful. And it limits a person's experience. No, I would think that the best preparation for life as a writer would be to have a great many experiences of all kinds, and to travel and to fall in with crowds of odd people, and to get close enough to them to be able to absorb their language and their lives. And this simply was not possible for me. I was terribly, terribly cautious and fearful. But I don't think it's any asset to a writer at all.
Are you still close to your cousin?
No. No, she went away, and she had a whole life that I was not privy to. We were not letter writers. I've seen her a few times since, and I enjoy being with her, but more than that, I enjoy the memory of having known her so well years ago. But I haven't been part of her life in so long, so it's hard to know what to say.
My guest is Garrison Keillor. His new novel is called Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Garrison Keillor is my guest, and his new novel is called Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. I want to ask you about something that's very much in the present tense, and that's your health. You had heart surgery over the summer in late August. What was the problem?
I inherited from my father's side of the family this sort of clicky heart. It's called a mitral valve prolapse. And I've been aware of it since I was about 14 and wanted to go out for football, and the doctor wouldn't let me. He said I had a murmur. It was no problem until late in the spring when the little flaps of the valve, it's like two parachutes sitting together, a cord ruptured and one of the flaps came loose. And suddenly, Your little prolapse turns into a major thing, and you go from being in your extremely late 40s to being in your mid 80s, and you breathe hard if you even have to climb stairs. So that's what happened to me. My flap came loose up there between the atrium and the ventricle.
As somebody who's very self-conscious, do you find yourself thinking about your heart all the time now and listening to it and always wondering, like, is it working right now?
No, not at all. Not whatsoever. I found it to be a great experience, really. I was impressed from the very beginning by the expertise and the quality of the hospital that I went to. And when you are reassured that you are in good hands, you're able to take it as an experience and look around you, and you're sort of a tourist, you know, right up until the moment they slide you onto the big table, and you look around at all the lamps and the people in blue, and then suddenly it's 8 hours later. I was intrigued by it. And then, of course, you know, to go through heart surgery, just the phrase open heart surgery is still has a lot of moral clout to it, you know. So people really respect you more than they need to, and give you all sorts of sympathy that you're not entitled to.
Why not? Why aren't you entitled to it?
Because it's an ideal medical situation, unlike most situations that people find themselves in, this is a problem that is crystal clear, and nobody has to work very hard to find out what is wrong. They know what is wrong, and there is no gray area here. There is one solution for this problem, and that is to operate and do this particular operation. You suffer very little pain and distress, and then as a beautiful aftermath of the operation, you get to enjoy a long convalescence. I had a convalescence of about 5 weeks. I could have stretched that to 6, even 8, I think. How often does a person have a chance to take 5 weeks off?
Well, it wasn't exactly a holiday, but I know what you mean.
When you've had open heart surgery, that is currency.
Right, right.
You can present that to everybody you ever promised you'd do something, and you're off the hook.
Yeah, yeah.
Any speech you have, any any concert you were scheduled to do, any benefit or anything, you just present that card. You know, it's the get off the hook card, and nobody questions it.
You wrote a piece in Time magazine about your surgery and your recovery, and you described yourself in the hospital in your weakened state, a shambling galoot in droopy pajamas, and you said, "This is not a guy whom any woman longs to have sex with. She would be afraid of killing the old bugger." You know, and you're talking about, like, right after the surgery. So I was thinking, you know, here you are having just published this book that is a novelistic version of your coming of age as a writer and your sexual coming of age. And just as you're publishing this novel and talking about this novel, you're connecting to a version of yourself that felt much older than you really are because of the surgery, because of, you know, the difficulty of recovering from it. So just thinking about that disconnect of, you know, experiencing at the same time a version of yourself which is much older than you really are and a version of yourself which is much younger than you really are.
Was there a question mark there? Or?
Yeah, the simultaneity. The question is, thank you. And the question is, Garrison Keillor, what is it like now to be experiencing simultaneously this young version of yourself and an elderly version of yourself?
Each writer has but a few themes, if the truth be told. Writers repeat themselves constantly, and we disguise it as best we can, but we keep coming back to it. And one of the themes in my writing, I think, is a craving for elegance that I suppose is a product of having grown up in the country and to people who did not have much money and to people whose deepest religious faith was really opposed to elegance and to show and to, sophistication. All my life I've been fascinated by elegance and seeing it in other people and, of course, wanting to appropriate it for myself. Elegance is a combination of wit and simplicity and a direct stylistic effect that you spend your whole life learning, and then you lose it. You don't have it at the beginning when you're 14 years old and you're clumping around in big shoes and these pipe stem arms and weird home-cut hair, and then inevitably you lose it again when you get older.
Is that something you worry about, you know, that years from now you might lose that sense of elegance in your life?
Gosh, no. No, it doesn't worry me at all. Now that I've had this 5 weeks off, now I can see what the rest of life is like. And it's pretty good. Sitting in a sunny corner of the kitchen with no obligations whatsoever and living a life of sheer, unbridled indolence is a fate to be wished. It's a great life. It's a beautiful life, doing nothing. Laziness, I can't recommend it highly enough.
Are you too much the worker to have thought that you could be comfortable with 5 weeks of not working?
I've often thought about how beautiful it would be to have 5 weeks off. I've thought of this at various times when I looked at my calendar and my obligations and the lies I have told to people whom I owe things, you know, about when I would finish them. I've looked at my calendar and it is the old briar patch. I've often thought about how wonderful it would be to have time off, and it is wonderful. It is absolutely great. I can't recommend it highly enough.
I suggest we all try to find ways of doing it without the heart surgery part.
If you need a cover, that's a good one.
Thanks for the advice. Garrison Keillor, it was just terrific to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Garrison Keillor has written a new novel called Lake Wobegon Summer, 1956. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on Howard Tate, a soul singer making a comeback. This is Fresh Air. The history of soul music is littered with collaborations which produced magic, but for only a moment, as well as dozens of performers who made a few great records and then vanished. The story of Howard Tate and Jerry Ragavoy has both of those elements, but with Tate's recent comeback, it also has a happy ending. Rock historian Ed Ward fills us in on the background.
When you see me worried, baby, baby, it's you I hate to lose. Nobody.
The best piece of news I've gotten so far this year was when someone emailed me a story from the New York Times that said that not only had the great soul singer Howard Tate resurfaced after decades, but that he'd been reunited with his old producer, Jerry Ragavoy. Neither of these guys is a household name, but they both should be. Tate was born in Macon, Georgia in 1938, but moved to Philadelphia as a small child. As a teenager, he sang in a group called the Gainers alongside Garnett Mims, who left them to start a group called the Enchanters. The Enchanters, in turn, were produced by Jerry Ragavoy, who was, along with Jerry Wexler, one of those great white producers with golden ears for black music. Baby was probably Garnett Mims and the Enchanters' most famous moment, a moderate hit in 1963, and later a centerpiece of Janis Joplin's show. Ragavoy also produced another record which was associated with her.
Didn't I make you feel like you were the only man? Didn't I give you everything that a woman possibly can?
Irma Franklin, one of Aretha's sisters, made that record in 1967, and Janis snatched it right up. Around that same time, Ragavoy, who was based in Philadelphia, was listening to a demo tape of a song a vocal group had sent him, and a voice jumped right out at him. It took him months to find the singer, who, it turned out, was driving a cab right there in Philly. Ragavoy took him into the studio, and before long, he had a hit.
Upon a time, a long, long time ago, some pain and misery. Now you standing on my doorstep. Tell me how much you need me. Ain't nobody home, girl. Ain't nobody home. How
Ain't Nobody Home was Tate's second single, and it did well enough that the record company wanted more. The one they got is Tate's best-known song, one which predicted the invention of Viagra and matched the last record's success.
Look at Granny run, run, and Grandpa running close behind. Look at Granny run, run, there's something on Granddaddy's mind. He went to the doctor, got a brand new pill. The doctor said,
oddly, neither Look at Granny Run Run nor Ain't Nobody Home did all that well on the pop charts, but that didn't mean that pop singers weren't listening to Howard Tate. Janis Joplin, that big Jerry Ragavoy fan, certainly was.
In this world where people are fighting with each other, nobody to count on,
not even your brother. So if someone comes along who gives you genuine affection, get it while you can. Get it while you can. Get it while you can. Don't turn your back on love.
There was one more hit for the collaboration before Tate decided to look elsewhere for the fame which seemed to be eluding him. And this time it was Jimi Hendrix who took it over to the pop audience. And it did stop. Tate went over to Lloyd Price's Turntable label, and Ragavoy went his own way. They reunited in the early 70s on Atlantic Records, urged on by one of their biggest fans, Jerry Wexler, but the record flopped. The two parted ways again, and until recently, that was that. Ragavoy was living in Georgia, and Tate was presumed dead. He wasn't. Through a remarkable series of connections, a soul DJ found him living in New Jersey, and the tale of Tate's plunge into despair after his daughter died in a fire, his wife divorced him, and he became homeless emerged. After undergoing a spiritual experience in 1994, he became a minister, and he's hoping the album he's just recorded with Ragavoy will earn him enough money to pay for a church to preach in. Reports from his comeback show were very positive. It's an inspiring story, and I'd like to add my voice to the chorus, welcoming Howard Tate and Jerry Ragavoy back to the music business.
Rock historian Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
How come my bulldog don't bark, baby? When Big Jim comes around. Well, all right. How come my bulldog don't bow wow, baby? When Big Jim comes around. When everybody knows I got the meanest bulldog.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Book Magazine, for the passionate reader, featuring books, authors, and articles that read between the lines, in bookstores and online at bookmagazine.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with comic book artist Dan Clowes and director Terry Zweigoff about their film Ghost World, which is based on a comic book by Clowes. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.